each of those studies has significant design flaws
yes.
that imparts bias to it. So they concluded that they can't
really help
define
yeah.
what's going on.
So just recently, there has been two reviews of natural family planning studies. One by somebody by an M.D. Manhart and group, and Somoli and Robinson did a review, and I'm leaving it to one of the authors.
Can I have the clicker?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Well, this is me, and why am I here? I'm not a Brazilian rock star. I think the only thing that will follow me are flies.
You don't know
and dogs.
It, maybe.
But I'm a scientist by training, and I have a career in the healthcare industry. I spent my life basically developing drugs for over-the-counter prescription use, and I know all about phase 1, 2, and 3, and all that sort of stuff, and I've dealt with regulatory bodies throughout the world getting approval for things and stuff. So, but more importantly, for this conversation, my wife and I have been volunteer teachers of NFP for 28-plus years, so we've... seeing what happens with it. This is my Christmas present from the staff. I asked for a head of hair. So this is the recent review that came out in January. There was a group of us. We all came from different systems and different methods. And I would say one of the nice things about this activity, it was an opportunity for those folks in different NFP camps to finally work together and come to a common ground and a common understanding and a common appreciation. And so it was a lot of fun to be a part of that team. So we have experts on Creighton, we had experts on Billings, we had a lot of input from Richard for the Marquette expertise, Symptothermal model as well. I think all of them were the Georgetown people, 2-day method and standard days and stuff were active participants
as
well.
What is SORT, S-O-R-T?
Great question. SORT stands for Strength of Evidence Recommendation Taxonomy. Now, that's a lot of high, you know, $5 words for physicians. But basically, it's an evidence-level rubric that family physicians use, and many family practice journals insist on SORT criteria use. OFP is one of those. Okay, and essentially, it focuses on patient-centered outcomes. So if you think you have a cholesterol-lowering drug that's better than the competition because it lowers it 20 points less than the other guys, that's not a patient-centered outcome. That's nice for the lab people and the endocrinologist to know. But does it cause fewer heart attacks, fewer strokes? That would be a patient-centered outcome. Okay. And within this taxonomy, there's a way to judge the evidence of a specific study, and those are graded in a simple 1, 2, 3. And then you can take the family of studies around a particular topic area, a patient outcome that you're interested in, and then you can level an evidence level for the strength of recommendation, which is an ABC kind of thing. So that's the rubric that we used in this review article. This is the decision tree to decide how good a study is. And as you said, first it's got to be meaningful to the patient. So the topic we chose was use of family planning methods to avoid pregnancy. We didn't do all stuff. We just focused in on avoidance of pregnancy. Okay. It has to be on a patient-oriented outcome. Am I pregnant or not? Right? I don't care what my luteinizing hormone level may be or what my estrogen level may be. I care whether or not I'm pregnant or not. Okay. If it's based on opinion, bench research, it can't be that. It's got to be more. It's got to be one of the following: a systemic review, randomized trial, high quality randomized trial, and then this third category, high quality cohort study for prognosis. And since most of the NFP trials fall into this category, the challenge for us as an author team was, how do you decide what's a high quality cohort study? And so we developed, with input from a number of NFP researchers around the world, a scoring sheet and a rubric, and these are the 12 critical criteria that we came up with. So for a good study, you obviously have to enroll sexually active, fertile women. You know, we could get 100% efficacy if we only studied them on cloistered nuns, right? But it wouldn't be very meaningful. It needs to be properly sized. You have to say, what's my intent? If you can't look at 10 patients and see if 2 get pregnant, that doesn't mean there's a 20% pregnancy rate there. That's not enough to know. It's got to be properly sized. Standardized counseling, there's a whole number of criteria here. I won't spend time going through it, but we actually did this, and for all the studies that we reviewed, we then applied the scoring criteria. For the scope of the review, to go back and look what's the literature you want to examine, we used 1980 as a cutoff. So we want to look at every study published in a peer-reviewed journal from 1980 forward. The reason we did that is there's not a lot of studies in the NFP world. For perspective, if I was going to do a randomized review, a systematic review of a current drug therapy or something, I'd only go back 5 years, and I'd probably find 300 or 400 citations that I could work with. In the NFP world, we're way down in the minor leagues in terms of production. But importantly, 1980 marks the date when the five-country World Health Organization study Billings was published, and that really is a huge landmark in the NFP research world. The stuff before that was really, it was good effort and best efforts, but it really wasn't solid science, well thought out, prospectively designed. The WHO trial was the first time that we really had a good application of non-biased research in the NFP world. From that, we found about 150 citations in total that were of relevance, and about 80 of those were reviewed in depth. Many of those were publications about the same study or different aspects and stuff. So in trial, then, we found 29 trials that specifically looked at the outcome of avoiding pregnancy, included about 8,000 women in total and somewhere over 100,000 cycles. Now, that sounds like a good number, right? It seems like a pretty good match. For perspective, though, and we also did find that for every method that we examined, there's at least one study that we would call level one evidence, a good, well-conducted study. Okay. Now, that sounds pretty good, but let me give you some perspective. This was a drug I worked on for osteoporosis. We had 10 separate phase 3 studies. Those are the studies at the end of the road among the patient population of interest for the indication we expect to get the approval. We had 15,000 people followed for up to 10 years. And we not only had, you know, the original pivotal publications, but we generated about 20 to 30 publications per year for the next 5 years from that database just by continuing to dredge that. So we have good data in the NFP world, but we got to recognize that relative to some of the serious players, we have a mountain to climb, and we really could use a whole lot more in that way. When you look at the NFP studies that are out there, there's a number of key issues that sort of are critical design flaws that you got to be mindful of. One of these, particularly in the earlier days, is learning periods. A lot of trials that gave people 3 to 4 months to learn the lessons, to learn how to chart and everything before they started counting whether or not they got pregnant. Well, you don't take your allergy medication for 3 or 4 months to learn if it's going to work before you start deciding if it's going to work. Right? And if you're a user, you want to know right away. High dropout rate, the Wade study that was a randomized comparison study, there were more dropouts than people could finish the study. So those that you don't know what happened to could have dramatically changed the outcome of that. That's why dropout's important. The NFP world has used the pearl rate as a statistical test for efficacy because it's simple and it's easy, but it's got a lot of inherent bias that actually overestimates the actual efficacy. And so it's more appropriate to use life table survival analysis, which is what our criteria called for. A lot of the studies were looking backwards. They had a bunch of data, a bunch of charts in their files. They got them out, and they called it a trial. Well, there's an inordinate amount of bias that you don't even appreciate by sort of looking backwards, right? Hindsight is always 20/20. Some stuff is published in bulletins, but never peer-reviewed. So you don't know that that's been willing to be subject to external review. And there's a lot of inconsistency and a lack of clarity in the rules. There was a nice big symptom thermal study done around 5 countries by Rice, I believe it was. It was published in the 90s. And essentially, if you went in and you looked at what each country taught for symptom thermal, it was a completely different set of rules. And what they did to collect the data was they found the least common denominator among those rules, and that's what they reported on. So in fact, the outcome that they reported for effectiveness of pregnancy was in fact never taught in any single country to any person. It was part of some larger thing. So what's the method that's there? And that's a critical issue in a lot of the studies. So when we went through those 29 studies, these were kind of the best. This is published in the paper itself, and you can see the unintended pregnancy rate when the method is used correctly, the unintended pregnancy rates when the methods are used typically, I should say, the sort level scores, and then our scores and the specific citation. So the symptothermal method, as used by the Germans, the double-check method, has 2 trials. And those trials were actually big enough that you could subset out the use of that with barrier methods concurrently. So those are almost like 2 studies within 2 studies. Creighton has 2 studies that show correct use. the way that the Creighton model reports what we would call typical use is not at all consistent with how the rest of these studies are reported. They talk about achieving-related behavior and all, which is different than the typical use definition. So we had to leave that blank, actually, for what the effectiveness is in typical use situations. And then you see the Billing study. This is the WHO trial. And we used the Trussell citation because they took the actual database and went back and reapplied without a learning period with the appropriate statistics and that sort of stuff. But because that was retrospective, it had to be scored as evidence level 2 rather than evidence level 1. And then this was the Marquette stuff before Richard published his latest randomized control trial, the 2-day method and the standardized method. So, and as I said, there's been new data since we published in January. The Marquette model, which is a randomized comparison, so this is a top of the chart kind of evidence level here, and it basically was monitor alone versus mucus alone, and you can see in a perfect use situation there was no difference between the unintended pregnancy rate use, but in a typical use situation, those who used the monitor had a significantly lower unintended pregnancy rate than those who used mucus observation alone, as taught by the Marquette system. Okay, so here we actually have a high-level comparison between two methods, if you would, for the first time.
Did you say that was the first time?
First time. There are other comparisons. There's at least three studies that have done comparisons, but they're a combination of retrospective work or they've got some inherent issues with them so that there's biases in there that you really can't understand. So you'll see where the grades come out when we talk about that. In our paper, then, what we did is we said... Then once we've graded the evidence level, we then go to the strength of recommendation, which is to look at all the evidence. So we said for top-level evidence A, symptothermal and symptothermal plus barriers has evidence level A, and Creighton, when it applied for correct use only, has evidence level A, because it's got at least two studies. The rest of them, it falls to evidence level B, basically because there was a single study that was well-designed and well-run. Okay, and now we have a new one with the randomized control trial. But again, it's a single time. If you're going to get a drug approved, you need at least two well-controlled studies to get approval. And so from my regulatory background, that for me would be sort of the top of the pyramid. So the conclusions we made is that fertility awareness methods do have robust effectiveness. They can be as effective as hormonal contraceptives, but much more research is needed, obviously. And importantly, we stressed in this article, which is targeted to family physicians, that these methods are more than just a means to postpone pregnancy. And we try to emphasize that family physicians, since they pride themselves on their ability to help patients change behaviors, that they're uniquely situated to be purveyors and helpers of patients who want to learn how to use these fertility-based methods. So, how good are the grades? To prevent pregnancy, when the methods are used correctly, I'd give them an A. At least a couple of them have A's for sure. Richard says B, so it's good. When used typically, I give it an A. Richard gives it a B. There's a difference there. While we may not like the numbers we see for typical numbers, I think they're pretty robust, and I think they're sort of in the range of what we might expect. Is there a difference for methods in the typical use? Well, we've really got mixed data. We've got the one study that looked at the Marquette the monitor alone versus the Marquette mucus alone. That's clearly showing a difference. There is some indication in the literature that there is differences between the methods with typical use. But again, each of those trials have some methodological faults. Not all the same fault, but they each have some methodological faults that says you really don't yet have good evidence to say there's a difference. And do we know these are as good as oral contraceptives? Well, the numbers look about the same. But when the numbers look about the same, that doesn't necessarily mean they're really on the same. So we say, both of us say, no evidence at this point in time. Okay. So, should we move on?
Yep.
Okay.
Will this presentation be available?
Yes. I'm going to...
Uh-oh. Yeah. You want to pull your names from it before you...
No. I'm looking to book both the audio file as well as see if I could do the PowerPoint up on our website as well with whatever edits that our doctors here need to make to the PowerPoint.
It's got to be a quick question because we're going to do questions at the end. So, all right. I'll also have a better answer for the one that question you asked me. just regards to quickly my B grading, when you look at some of these, the methodologies on the studies, and you pick out some of their cherry picking, and also to really do correct use and typical use, you have to have cycle by cycle, you have to have their intention, and looking at their intercourse patterns. If you don't have that, you can't do correct use. And even with the Frank Herman study, they only had 85% of the cycles they were able to find that. And then when they looked at that subset, actually the typical use went down to about 7.5. I also look at when things look way out of different than what I can find and doing real good research, you know, some fantastic results, it always ends up a little feelers, ooh, there might be something wrong here. So those are just some of the things I look at. Now I'm looking at achieving pregnancy. Well, the Germans, again, the German group did a study in human reproduction. Notice they do the high-level peer-reviewed journals. This is et al., I believe, Frank Herman and Freundel and all that group was part of this study. 346 women, they were using STM, but their time to intercourse act identification of the peak fertility according to vulvar mucus sensations. Their cumulative probabilities conception, that's not percent, this is again, using survival analysis, they went from 38.68 to 92% at 1, 3, 6, and 12 months of use. Now, you think, great, after 12 months, 92%. But that's within a cohort of pretty well-off symptothermal users. We don't know if that's any better than random intercourse among users, if they would have done anything. So there's no evidence these rates are better than random intercourse, which is about 85, 86, some people even say up to 90% if you have a population-based women within reproductive age having random intercourse, it could go up to 90%. So is it more effective using NFP? Well, this shows some evidence, not very good evidence. Dr. Hilders et al., Diane Daly, and so forth, did a study with where they got with 49 of 50 couples of normal fertility achieve a pregnancy within 5 months with focusing intercourse. The problem with this, they looked at retrospectively people using achieving-related behavior and looked at people who already got pregnant, and yeah, they got fantastic pregnancy rates, but there's some problems. There's problems with a lot of studies. There are actually two randomized control trials. Drug companies, manufacturers of medical equipment have more money to be able to do things. This is through, used to be UniPath and now Swiss Precision, which is part of Procter & Gamble. They actually did a study, that's Jeanette Robinson-Welkin. They looked at 1,000 women, they randomized into 500 receiving an electronic hormonal fertility monitor, Clear Blue, versus a group of 500. Now, these other 500 could use ovulation test kits, basal body temperature, and so forth. So it was sort of a comparison of the monitor use with what couples use with in practice. You know, they go out and buy LH sticks or things like that. So that's what they looked at. But they did find differences in rate. During the first cycle, it was 15.2% versus 78.8%. And then after two cycles, it was 22.7 to 14.4, which is statistically significant. However, again, this is only two cycles, but it's a randomized control trial. Just recently, they also was sponsored by, which is called Swiss Precision right now, another randomized study. And the reason they did this study, if you look at some of the expert guidelines for practice, the European, what's called NICE guidelines, they say they do not recommend using focused intercourse because they think it's too stressful for couples. They just recommend frequent intercourse. So they were challenging whether it is stressful for couples to use markers of fertility to target their intercourse. And they did a study where they looked at cortisol levels and things like that. And essentially, this showed it wasn't stressful for couples to use focused intercourse. But as a side thing, they also were looking at pregnancy rates, and they found that those that use this, it's really a digital LH test, that they had a 43% pregnancy rate with the digital LH, versus a 30% with the control group, and that odds ratio was that there was a 59% greater compared to the control group of achieving pregnancy. So there is two randomized, there's problems with it. I recently did a study with one of my PhD students, Quinn Yu, and We looked at the reverse of achieving related pregnancy of a survival analysis. So we looked at people who were having intercourse on high and peak day, whether it's mucus or the monitor, versus couples or versus cycles where you're not using it correctly. If you're trying to achieve pregnancy, not correct use is not having intercourse during the identified fertile time. So we pulled out the correct use cycles and the imperfect or incorrect use cycles to look at differences in pregnancy rate. And we came out to 87 per 100 women at 12 months using the high and peak days, focus intercourse, versus 5 per 100 not having it. Now, that stands to reason, but there's not a lot of evidence for this. And we're going to be publishing it in the American Journal of Maternal and Child Nursing. So, my summary, there is growing evidence to show that focused intercourse during the fertile time, as estimated by self-monitoring of natural biological markers of fertility, will increase pregnancy rates. Not real good, but there's summary. There's only 2 randomized trials. The National Institute for Clinical Excellence, that's the European guidelines, specified to state that use of focused intercourse is too stressful and normal affected than having intercourse 2 to 3 times a week. Think about it. If you have intercourse 2 to 3 times a week, you will be hitting that 6-day fertile window. The American Society of Reproductive Medicine policy says recommends that electronic or other devices that are designed to aid couples in determining optimal time of fertility may be useful for couples who have infrequent intercourse. Actually, the intercourse pattern is every other day in regards to the maximum amount of sperm and semen regards to is every other day. So, these are our grades. Ooh, Mike gave it a B, Dr. Matt. I gave it a C.
It's like grading movies, thumbs up, thumbs down.
Yeah, thumbs up, thumbs down. Again,
are you Siskel or am I even?
Next topic.
I know who I want for a teacher.
Yeah.